From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is a landmark ruling which affirms the right of all individuals in this country to habeas corpus and the right not to be detained without due process of law.
In a major setback for the Bush administration, a federal appeals court rules the administration cannot label U.S. residents enemy combatants and jail them indefinitely without charge. Then soldiers speaking out against war.
We are the weapons of this democracy, ruled by the people. But our democracy has failed us.
Marine Sergeant Adam Kokesh, a military panel is recommending his honorable discharge be revoked for wearing his uniform during an anti-war protest without permission. We'll also go to Bellingham, Washington, to Private First Class Evan Knappenberger, who stood outside the federal building dressed in his fatigues 24 hours a day to protest the military's stop-loss policy, sending soldiers back to Iraq again and again and again. Then welcome to the Terror Dome, the pain, politics, and promise of sports. We'll speak with political sports writer Dave Zirin. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal appeals court has dealt a major setback to the Bush administration over its power to jail U.S. citizens and legal residents without charge. The court ruled the Bush administration cannot label U.S. residents enemy combatants and jail them indefinitely. The ruling came in the case of the only person still held as an enemy combatant on U.S. soil, Ali Al-Mari, who was arrested 5 years ago at his home in Peoria, Illinois. Writing for the majority, Judge Diana Gribben-Motz said authorizing indefinite military detention, quote, would have disastrous consequences for the Constitution and the country. She continued, quote, we refuse to recognize a claim to power that would so alter the constitutional foundations of our republic. We'll have more on the ruling after headlines. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans blocked a no-confidence vote on Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez Monday, but more than the majority of the Senate indicated they no longer have confidence in the Attorney General. This is Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
There is no liberal or conservative or Democratic or Republican position on the Attorney General's lack of independence and commitment to rule of law. It is virtually unanimous.
Seven Republicans, including Arlen Specter, joined Democrats in allowing the vote to go forward. But the Democrats failed to get the needed 60 votes to end debate and have the vote take place. Independent Joe Lieberman of Connecticut voted with the Republicans. President Bush said he still has confidence in Gonzalez.
They can try to have their votes. I have no confidence, but it's not going to make the determination who serves in my government.
In Afghanistan, U.S. forces have killed seven Afghan police officers and wounded four others. Afghan officials say the U.S. ground forces mistook the police officers as Taliban fighters. This comes as the International Red Cross is warning violence is intensifying throughout Afghanistan. The Red Cross blamed the increased fighting on Taliban militants as well as U.S.-led troops. One official said, quote, civilians suffer horribly from mounting threats to their security, such as increasing numbers of roadside bombs and suicide attacks and regular aerial bombing raids. The Red Cross said it has become increasingly challenging to carry out humanitarian work outside major cities. Meanwhile, Afghan police have arrested 11 men suspected of being involved in an attempt to kill Afghan President Hamid Karzai. On Sunday, rockets were fired at a school in the Ghazni province where Karzai was visiting. A new study estimates the Iraq war will end up costing the United States a total of nearly $2.3 trillion by the year 2016. The estimates included in a new survey on military spending by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI. The institute has determined that global military spending topped $1.2 trillion last year. This marks a 37% increase over the past 10 years. The U.S. remains by far the biggest military spender and accounts for nearly half the world's military spending. Last year, the U.S. spent at least $529 billion, more than 10 times what China spent. In Iraq, for the second time in 2 days, al-Qaeda fighters have blown up a bridge near Baghdad. Iraqi officials say al-Qaeda is now mounting a campaign to destroy key transportation arteries and other parts of Iraq's infrastructure. Meanwhile, Iraqi lawmakers have voted to replace the Speaker of the Parliament, Mahmoud al-Mashadani. He was removed after one of his bodyguards beat up another lawmaker. Last year, Mashadani praised Iraqi militants who killed U.S. forces. He said, quote, "I personally think whoever kills an American soldier in defense of his country should have a statue built for him in that country." Oil workers in southern Iraq have stopped their week-long strike after Prime Minister Maliki pledged to form a government committee to address their complaints. The oil workers went on strike to protest wages and the planned privatization of Iraq's oil resources. A new study has found the suicide rate of U.S. war veterans is double the rate of ordinary civilians. The study examined data on 300,000 men dating back to World War II. Disabled veterans or those who had experienced emotional or psychological trauma during their service were identified as the highest risk group. In other military news, the Army's fallen short of its May recruiting goal. The Army signed up 5,100 soldiers last month, 400 fewer than expected. Gaza appears to be closer to being engulfed in a civil war. At least 17 Palestinians have died in the past day in intense fighting between Hamas and Fatah. Earlier this morning, a rocket-propelled grenade hit the home of Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh. It was the third attempt on his life in 24 hours. An officer with Mahmoud Abbas's presidential guard said several mortar bombs also struck the president's compound in Gaza City. No one was hurt. Both Hamas and Fatah have used websites and text messages to call for the execution of the other side's military and political leaders. Four people died after a shootout inside a hospital in northern Gaza. In the town of Beit Lahia, Hamas fighters assassinated one of the most senior Fatah leaders in Gaza, Jamal Abu al-Jadian. He was a co-founder of Fatah's Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. Hamas fighters attacked Jadian's house, dragged him into the street, then shot him 45 times. In Lebanon, fighting is also continuing between Lebanese troops and Sunni militants holed up in a Palestinian refugee camp. On Monday, two Red Cross aid workers were killed and a Palestinian mediator wounded. At least 132 people have been killed in the past 3 weeks there. In news from Africa, a group of international judges criticized the treatment of lawyers in Zimbabwe. The Geneva-based International Commission of Jurists said it was shocked by the extent of government abuse of the legal and judicial system. This is Claire Leredoub of the ICJ.
The mission is disturbed that the unjustifiable harassment, detention, and beating of lawyers has only increased the tension between the law society and the government. Such treatment is interfering with the proper functioning of the administration of justice, the role of lawyers and their independence, and is making it difficult for lawyers to act for clients viewed by the government as dissidents.
Nixon Nikadzino of the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition praised the findings of the International Commission of Jurists.
What the report is basically doing is to prove what we've always said as Zimbabweans who are concerned, that the situation back home is actually deteriorating and getting to an extent whereby we really need a quick and fast intervention, particularly through the initiatives that are taking place when President Thabo Mbeki is going to negotiate.
In Georgia, a state judge has ordered the release of a young African-American man who's been serving a 10-year prison sentence for having consensual oral sex with another teenager. At the time, Janarla Wilson was 17 years old. The girl was 15. Wilson was convicted of felony aggravated child molestation. He's already spent 2 years behind bars. Since Wilson was convicted, Georgia changed its law on teenage sex. After the judge ordered Wilson's release Monday, Georgia's Attorney General Thurbert Baker surprised many by appealing the judge's order. Civil rights leaders condemned the state's appeal. The Reverend Joseph Lowry wrote a letter to Baker asking, quote, "Where is your conscience that you would allow this travesty to occur on your watch?" In Washington, D.C., opposition is growing against President Bush's nominee to become the next Surgeon General. The nation's largest gay rights group, Human Rights Campaign, is urging senators to reject the confirmation of Dr. James Holsinger. Holsinger's argued that homosexuality is unnatural and dangerous, and that sexual orientation is a lifestyle choice. In 2000, he helped form the Hope Springs Community Church, which has a special program that it claims to cure gay men and lesbians. If confirmed as Surgeon General, Holsinger would become the country's chief health educator. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's confirmed it once considered building a chemical weapon that could turn enemy soldiers into homosexuals and make them more interested in sex than fighting. Newly declassified documents show the Ohio Air Force Lab asked for $7.5 million in 1994 to develop a so-called gay bomb. A new study on media coverage of the Iraq War has found Fox News has spent far less time covering the war than CNN or MSNBC. The Project for Excellence in Journalism examined the news coverage in the first 3 months of the year. It found during daytime news shows, Fox spent only 6% of the time discussing the war. CNN spent 20%, MSNBC 18%. And finally, the philosopher Richard Rorty has died at the age of 75. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration has been dealt a major setback in its treatment of prisoners in the so-called war on terror. On Monday, a federal appeals court ruled the administration cannot label U.S. residents enemy combatants and jail them indefinitely without charge. The ruling came in the case of the only person still held as an enemy combatant on U.S. soil. Ali Al-Mari was arrested 5 years ago at his home in Peoria, Illinois, where he lived with his wife and five children. He had come from his native Qatar to study computer science at Bradley University. Al-Mari was initially charged with credit card fraud and lying to federal agents. But in June 2003, President Bush declared him an enemy combatant and ordered him into military custody. He spent the last 4 years in solitary confinement at a Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina. The government says Al-Mari is part of an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell, but has not charged him with any crime. Writing for the majority, Judge Diana Gribben-Motz said authorizing indefinite military detention, quote, would have disastrous consequences for the Constitution and the country. She continued, we refuse to recognize a claim to power that would so alter the constitutional foundations of our republic. I'm joined now by Jonathan Hafitz. He's the lead counsel in the Al-Mari case and litigation director at the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jonathan.
Thank you, Amy.
What is your reaction to this ruling?
This is a monumental victory for the rule of law in the United States, a vindication of basic constitutional principles, the right to habeas corpus, to challenge your detention in a federal court, and the principle that no person can be held without due process of law.
Did it surprise you?
Well, we were certainly very pleased by the ruling. And, you know, it's kind of hard to believe, actually, we're actually talking about this issue, that the notion that the president can just lock someone up, citizen or non-citizen in this country, based upon suspicion, and hold them potentially for life without charge is so antithetical to the principles this country was founded on that, you know, it's stunning that the claims that they make for sweeping power.
Tell us who the prisoner is. Tell us who this man being held in South Carolina in the brig is, Al-Mari.
He is a 41-year-old man, citizen of Qatar, who came to the United States lawfully to study and obtain a master's degree at Bradley University in Illinois. He came with his wife and five children. And he was arrested initially as a material witness in the 9/11 investigation and then charged with a crime, as you noted. But before his trial was scheduled to commence, the president declared him an enemy combatant and stripped him of all his rights, essentially took him from the criminal justice system where the Bill of Rights applies and put him in legal limbo in solitary confinement in a military brig where he was held incommunicado and subjected to abuse and mistreatment and even denied access to his lawyers.
So how did you represent him?
Well, initially, we for the first 16 months after he was declared an enemy combatant, that is from June 2003 to October 2004, we represented him without being able to speak to him. We were, you know, filed papers on his behalf and asserted a right to meet with him and to challenge his detention, but the government refused. They would not allow him to even speak with his attorneys, let alone with anyone else in the outside world, including his wife and five children, who he's not spoken with since he was first arrested. So that's how we tried to do it. Eventually, we were able to get access to him, and we've now continued to fight for his right to not be held without charge.
Why hasn't the military charged him?
We really don't know. I mean, there are a couple of possible explanations. One is they don't have the evidence. Mr. Almari has maintained from the beginning that he's innocent. Another possible reason is that they wanted to subject him to coercive interrogations, which he had to endure, the extreme isolation, the sensory deprivation, the abuse, the threats, which they could not have done in the civilian justice system.
Has he told you about this?
Absolutely. And we filed a separate lawsuit in 2005.
Can you go further into exactly what he's been subjected to?
Well, initially he was subjected held incommunicado, as I mentioned, without any access to anyone in the outside world. He was held in a tiny cell with no one to talk to. It was all metallic surfaces. He developed severe pain. He was denied things like a blanket, denied the Quran, subjected to religious abuse, not permitted to practice Islam, denied any kind of stimulation. What I mean by any books, any knowledge of the what was going on, just basically locked in a cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, not permitted to see sunlight. There were threats made against him, against his family, that his family would be sent to Egypt, his wife would be raped. Just actually horrible things. Now, this has improved somewhat, in part response to the lawsuit we filed, in part response to actually the men and women at the military brig who are not setting the policy realize they have a human being there and are acting accordingly. But, at the highest levels of government, there was a decision made to detain him as an enemy combatant, to subject him to this kind of torture and abuse that you can't get away with in the civilian justice system because it's flatly illegal and unconstitutional.
Now, Ali Almari was held in the same brig in South Carolina as Jose Padilla, or Padilla, the name has been pronounced right, both different ways. The U.S. citizen held as an enemy combatant for 3.5 years, now moved to Miami, where he's being tried for terrorism charges in a federal court there. What is happening in Jose Padilla's case?
Well, a couple of things. You know, first of all, you see that the fact-finding, the importance of a criminal trial to find out what the truth is. There have been some, the witnesses are being presented, evidence is being presented, and there's going to be an adjudication. I don't know which way it will come out, but one way or other, another about the Jose Padilla's guilt or innocence. That doesn't happen in this enemy combatant world where there's no hearing, there's no witnesses, there's no evidence. You don't find the truth. And second, I think what's notable about Jose Padilla's case is that he was not charged with any of the allegations, the charges did not reflect any of the allegations on which he was detained as an enemy combatant. That is, that he was supposed to explode a dirty bomb. They didn't charge him with that in the civilian court because, as administration officials have said, the evidence by which that those allegations or that information was obtained was illegal and unconstitutional. It was obtained through torture. So, that's what the enemy combatant policy is. It's a way to shield, in part, coercive interrogations, torture, and other abuse from scrutiny by putting someone in a legal limbo where there's no hearing, no witnesses, no due process, no scrutiny of the government's evidence.
Jonathan Haifetz, how do these cases relate to the hundreds of men who are being held at Guantanamo? Do they have any effect?
Well, certainly Mr. Almari is in a different situation in that he's in the United States, he's a legal resident, he has undisputed constitutional rights, including a right to habeas corpus and due process. However, the court's ruling transcends his case in that it rejects the administration's sweeping definition of a combatant, that a combatant is someone that whoever the president says he is, a definition that's untethered from traditional notions of combatancy and the laws of war, and that ruling and that analysis will have implications, I believe, for others.
Padilla, his lawyers say, has now, because of sensory deprivation and torture, is psychologically, to say the least, very impaired, and thinks that his guards or his friends, his lawyers, his persecutors. How can he be tried?
Well, the judge, it's a good question. The judge made a ruling that he was competent to stand trial, although that's quite a low threshold. But I think the notion of what happened before really taints the criminal trial. And Mr. Almari underwent the same, if not worse, treatment than Jose Padilla. And there was a period of time a few years ago where we really felt he was, losing his mind. Things have improved, and he's, certainly competent and doing better. But this type of mistreatment really takes its toll and has irreparable consequences.
Finally, Jonathan Hayfetz, we last had you on talking about a New Jersey man, an American citizen who was being held in an Ethiopian prison, believed to be one of those black sites, U.S.-involved prisons where people are brought here, Somalia, Kenya. We were talking to Anthony Mitchell in Nairobi, who was the AP reporter who had exposed this story. He later died in the Kenyan Airways flight over Cameroon. But this young man, Amir Mohammed Mishal, has since been returned to New Jersey, to his family. Can you tell us, you represent him, what is his situation and what happened to him in Ethiopia?
Well, he's certainly home with his family now after 4 months of secret detention, rendition, and he's very happy to be home. But what went on raises, as we've noted, very serious questions about proxy detention, where the U.S. Essentially uses governments, other foreign governments like Ethiopia in this case, to detain American citizens without due process and beyond the rule of law, also rendition, where people are secretly transferred without judicial review to face mistreatment. So, I mean, this case, raises serious questions about the administration's approach to counterterrorism policy.
Mm-hmm. And last question. The ruling says the administration cannot label a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident and an enemy combatant and indefinitely hold them. What happens to someone who is not a legal resident, perhaps an undocumented worker who is picked up?
Well, I think that the analysis essentially is based on, the rule that if you're in the United States, that you have constitutional rights. Certainly lawful resident aliens have them, but also under Supreme Court precedent, any person in the United States has those rights. So I think that the argument that the decision would apply to those individuals as well.
Thank you very much for joining us. Jonathan Hayfetz, Litigation Director of the Liberty and National Security Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, an attorney for Ali Almari. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. Jafar Hassan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to two Iraq war veterans who are drawing the ire of the Pentagon for their vocal opposition to war. A military panel is recommending Marine Sergeant Adam Kokesh have his honorable discharge revoked for wearing his uniform at an anti-war protest. Kokesh is a member of Iraq Vets Against the War. The military began investigating him after the Washington Post published a photograph of him at an anti-war protest in March to mark the fourth anniversary of the war. Adam Kokesh also spoke last month in uniform during a Memorial Day protest here in New York.
Hey,
Bring our brothers and sisters still in Iraq home now. Who are we talking to? The electorate said it last November, but we have yet to see any results. We are the weapons of this democracy, ruled by the people. But our democracy has failed us. It is time for the people to end this war.
Marine Sergeant Adam Kokesh speaking here in New York last month. Today, Adam joins me from Washington, D.C., and we're joined on the telephone across the country by Private First Class Evan Knappenberger. On Thursday, he wrapped up an eight-day, 24-hour vigil in Bellingham, Washington, to protest the military's stop-loss policy. Stop-loss allows the military to extend soldiers' tour of duty and send them back to Iraq again and again. Evan Knappenberger on the phone with us from Bellingham. Let's start in Washington, D.C. Sergeant Adam Kokesh, talk about your situation right now, your protest in uniform. Why did you decide to wear your military uniform?
Well, good morning. That's a very good question, because a lot of the coverage has grossly simplified the issue and said that I wore my uniform to a protest, which isn't really accurate at all. What we were doing was conducting something called Operation First Casualty. And it's called that because it has long been said that the first casualty of war is the truth. And so what we did was conduct a mock combat patrol through the streets of Washington, D.C., in order to bring a small part of the truth of the occupation home to the American people and give them a small sense of what it's like to have squads of men in uniform with rifles, although we were simulating them, of course, running around the streets of their city. And we also had civilians playing affected peoples. They weren't playing Iraqis or pretending to speak Arabic or anything like that, but we treated them as we would treat Iraqi civilians on a daily basis. And so it was more street theater than general protest. And I don't need to show up to a protest in a uniform to represent myself as a veteran. But for this particular demonstration, we were simulating a combat patrol, and so that's what we did, and that's why it was appropriate in that setting. Now, normally, as I'm doing today, I wear this this Marine Corps boonie cover, and that's how I choose to represent myself as a veteran.
Were you surprised after the protest when the military decided to investigate, after your photograph appeared in the Washington Post?
Yeah, absolutely surprised. And the first thing that I got was an email from Major John White of the Marine Corps Mobilization Command informing me that he was investigating my case, and that I may be in violation of certain rules and regulations and so on. And my first reaction was surprise, absolutely, but also shock. And I was a little confused to see that the military was investigating a member of the inactive reserve who had been discharged honorably and was getting on with his life. And then upon reflection, I was deeply offended to see, you know, when I realized the implications of this, that the time of an active duty major is being used to investigate Marines in the inactive reserve on political grounds and based on their political activities. And I wrote him back a scathing email chastising him for wasting his time while we have Marines dying every day in Iraq on such a petty issue. And I said, this is not what Marine Corps leadership is supposed to be about. And I concluded by telling him, so no, I am not writing to or not responding to recognize my responsibilities under the rules and regulations, but rather to ask you to kindly please go F yourself. And of course, in the email, I spelled it out, because that's how Marines talk to Marines.
And now they are recommending that your honorable discharge be revoked?
Well, that's not exactly accurate either. But as a result of this email that I sent and the photographs of me taking part in this operation in uniform, the investigating officer recommended that I be separated from the inactive reserve with an other than honorable discharge. And the way it works is that you may receive multiple discharges throughout your military career, but it's your last one that is relevant in terms of your benefits. And so they would separate me and give me a new discharge, which normally you wouldn't even get from the inactive reserve. Your time would simply expire, and that would supersede my honorable discharge that I received for my service on active duty.
And what would that mean in your life to have an other than honorable discharge? Does that mean a dishonorable discharge?
Well, yes. There's a few categories, and it goes from honorable to general and then other than honorable before bad conduct and dishonorable. But other than honorable is across that line where my benefits would be revoked, essentially. I would not be qualified for the health care that I'm receiving now through the VA. I would lose the lifetime treatment for my service-related injuries, namely an elbow bursitis, which I may need an operation on soon, and my hypertension, which I developed at the age of 23 upon returning from Iraq. And theoretically, I might have to pay back some of the benefits that I got a stipend as a reservist going through college through the GI Bill.
I want to ask you in a minute about your time in Iraq, but I first want to go to Specialist Evan Knappenberger, also an Iraq War veteran, just finished up an 8-day, 24-hour-a-day vigil in Bellingham, Washington, also wearing his fatigues, standing outside the federal building. Evan Knappenberger, can you tell us what you did?
Well, yes, I decided a couple of weeks ago that I needed to do something to affect a positive change in all these kind of negative things going on. And I figured the best way to do that would be to draw some attention to these policies that the military is using to fight this war without actually, a war without conscription, basically. So I, in the middle of the night, I had this great idea, just a symbol of something kind of similar to what Operation First Casualty is, you know, to bring the war to the American people, because there is a big disconnect between the civilian population and those of us who were in Iraq, and we can see, us veterans of Iraq, we understand kind of the way that these policies get perpetrated, and the American people need to be made aware of that. So I had this great idea to bring that home, and I ended up on a tower for 8 days.
Ended up what?
I ended up sitting up on this tower for 8 days, wearing my uniform, kind of like I did in Iraq when I was guarding these fields in Iraq.
What fields? Where were you in Iraq?
I was on Camp Taji, which is north of Baghdad, and I ended up in Iraq. I did 97 nights on this tower, pretty much 10 hours a night, and guarding an empty field and a few shepherds. And I used to think when I was doing that what it would look like if I was guarding American soil or doing something actually worthwhile, in my opinion. And
did you fire your gun in Iraq?
No, I never fired my weapon in Iraq.
And in Bellingham, Washington, did you build this tower outside the federal building?
Yes, we did. And we were originally going to build a realistic tower. We ended up building a smaller one would be more effective to talk to people, because the goal, and I got criticized for this, the goal was not so much to be militarily realistic, but we wanted to kind of have some dialogue with people and do a watered-down version.
Now, Evan Knappenberger, you specifically targeted the stop-loss program. Can you explain what it is and why you feel this is the critical issue?
Yes, the stop-loss program is the military's euphemism for the policy that they use to extend soldiers without honoring their contractual obligations. They break their contracts to get them to stay in longer and do another tour, get the most out of the soldiers that they have. And it's not really legal. If we've been checking into the legality of it. It's very, very shady. It's one of those things. I had a reporter in Chicago describe it to me as better to ask forgiveness later. And I think it's wrong, and I think it's completely unjust. And
how many times have you been in Iraq?
I served a year in Iraq.
Sergeant Adam Kokes in Washington, D.C., where were you in Iraq and how long were you there?
I served in the Fallujah area as a sergeant on a civil affairs team from February to September of 2004.
Were you there during the siege of Fallujah?
Yes, I was there for the siege, the first battle of Fallujah in April for 18 days.
What happened there? What did you do there? What did you see?
Well, The infantry company that I was attached to was responsible for blockading the two bridges across the Euphrates coming out of Fallujah. And one of those bridges is the one that leads to the Fallujah General Hospital on the peninsula there. And so part of our job as a civil affairs team was to ensure that that hospital had what they needed to continue to operate and to run a checkpoint on the bridge so that people that actually needed medical attention could get across and get that. And there was a village that was cut off by our perimeter, and so we were distributing humanitarian rations to them as well.
Did you fire your gun?
No, fortunately, I was not faced with that responsibility. I had my share of combat. I got bullets bouncing off my door on a number of convoys and a few ambushes and received a lot of indirect fire. But every time we were being fired at, I was either driving or behind somebody. And most of the people that were firing were shooting at windows or shadows anyways.
And your estimation of the number of casualties in Fallujah under siege twice by the U.S. military?
Oh, well, there are experts who have tried to calculate, you know, how many there were. But we basically took a city that was 250,000 and 500,000 in the surrounding area and decimated it. And there's a huge, you know, displaced persons crisis because of that. A lot of people left the city, a lot of people that we let evacuate during the siege. And, you know, God only knows how many people actually died within the city limits of Fallujah during that siege and during the second battle in November.
Sergeant Kokesh, you also protested at the Alberto Gonzalez hearing last month, the Attorney General of the United States, and you held up a sign. Can you talk about what your point was and what was on that sign?
Absolutely. Well, I held a tally board where on one side it said, "I don't recall," and the other side I had tally marks for every time Alberto Gonzalez said those words or something very close to that effect. And it's silly being called a protester there because in most of the coverage, you know, nobody, of course, got my name. But more importantly, I wasn't even protesting anything. If anything, I was cheerleading the Democrats that were, and the Republican senators as well, that were holding the Attorney General's feet to the fire. I think that was a really important role for them to play. And I just wanted to encourage them and say, you know, don't pull any punches. And this was an idea we just briefly discussed the night before and thought, well, what are we expecting out of this testimony? And it was clear that he was going to do something to get out of it. And it just so happened that he used the phrase, "I don't recall," 74 times. And frankly, I thought that the Bushies would be on better message and wouldn't screw up like that. And I actually had numbers written down on individual sheets, and I was flipping through, and I got all the way up to 15, and I ran out of paper. So I had to start doing tally marks. That you know, my original intention wasn't even to do tally marks. But someone had told him that I was in the audience, and after lunch, for about 20 minutes, he didn't say, "I don't recall," once before losing it again. But he also said, "I don't," and caught himself at least 100 times. And I'd like to personally take credit for making him sound like twice the idiot he would have otherwise. But also, Senator Schumer mentioned in his closing remarks the count, of course, without pointing out the protester in the back of the room. So it was cool that it had an immediate effect. And sometimes, you know, pointing out something when you have something to point out that's actually relevant, you know, sometimes standing there holding a sign can actually make a difference.
I wanted to turn to Specialist Evan Knappenberger again in Bellingham, Washington, as we have this conversation in two Washingtons, from Washington, D.C. to Bellingham. You did your own study of civilian deaths in Iraq. How did you do it, Evan?
Well, I had a month-long project about this time last year, and I used a variety of methods. Basically, my job as an intelligence analyst entailed a lot of things, and none of us really got real training on the Iraq scenario. I trained on a North Korea scenario. So basically, we were making it up as we went, but trying to be as truthful as possible. I personally read through about 30,000 separate reports of civilian casualties in Iraq and put together a picture over a very long period of time of the situation around Baghdad as far as what they call SECMAC now, which is sectarian murders and killings. And after a month of reading through these reports, we started to get a picture of what was going on. Unfortunately, it was pretty much ignored by the chain of command.
You also participated in interrogations, Evan?
That's right, but we didn't call them interrogations. The terminology had to be changed, as is the case with many things we do in the military that we're not really allowed to do. If you change a name, you can, you're allowed to do it, because it's not, it's the same action, just a different name. We call them tactical questionings, and that's correct, I did do.
Where and who were you questioning, and who was in the room when you did it?
Well, I can't really go into specifics, but typically there would be one or two soldiers. At times it would be nobody more than two junior enlisted soldiers and an Iraqi interpreter and the suspect.
And where would the suspect come from? What kinds of questions were you asking?
Again, I can't be too specific, but typically the suspect would be somebody that was, one example, picked up on the street, violating a weapons permit, and the kind of questions we would ask were background questions. But if we could establish, the rule was we could hold these guys for 24 hours without doing any paperwork on them, and at the end of that 24 hours, we could, if we had enough on them, we could release, we could keep them in. Otherwise, we had to release them. But the problem then became getting something out of them to keep them.
Back to the study, what did you conclude in terms of civilian deaths in Iraq?
At the time, we had concluded that they were close to 750,000 civilian deaths over the course of the Iraq War. Now I would guess that it's probably upwards of 1,000,000.
Well, that actually coincides with the two studies done, most recent 1,000,000, and right before that, The Lancet, the British medical journal, published that study from Johns Hopkins University saying around 655,000 soldiers, civilians, had died in Iraq.
That's correct. And unfortunately, it took a lot of political pressure from studies like the Lancet study before the chain of command decided that sectarian violence was even a problem. And it was only afterwards that, I think it was after that report was published, that they decided to make a task force to investigate these sectarian killings.
I wanted to ask you about another issue that you looked at experienced among the soldiers, and that's the issue of suicide.
That's correct. Officially, the number, I believe, in Iraq of suicides is 122 as of last week. That doesn't sound exactly right to me. In my unit alone, we had 45 combat casualties and 15 suicides. And I would think that the 15 suicides, if you traced out the numbers, there'd be a third as many suicides as there were combat casualties. And I don't think the 122 suicides number meshes with that.
Are the suicides back here in the United States when soldiers return?
Oh, those aren't counted.
They're not counted. These are just suicides in Iraq.
Yeah.
Why aren't they not counted, the ones when soldiers come home?
Well, I would assume that it's political in nature. The Army doesn't want to admit to taking any more losses than they possibly can.
It's interesting, because in our headlines today, we reported on this new study that found the suicide rate of U.S. war veterans is double the rate of ordinary civilians.
No, it wouldn't surprise me. And that also, that doesn't include the number of guys who go out and get drunk and die in drunk driving accidents, which in my unit, in the month that we were back, we probably lost three or four guys that way, too. Hmm.
Well, as we wrap up, Sergeant Adam Kokesh, your thoughts right now, back in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., the level of support you've gotten inside the military from the top down, privately, perhaps people talking to you?
Well, actually, it's been quite surprising to see a lot of people from my old unit contacting me and supporting me in my efforts and trying to get to ensure that the Uniform Code of Military Justice is not implied beyond its jurisdiction into the inactive reserve. And they appreciate that. And I think a lot of people in the military appreciate what I'm doing and why I'm trying to fight this case so hard. And even though the board recommended me for a general discharge last week, which wouldn't affect my benefits, if it's approved, it doesn't do anything to establish a precedent. And the next guy facing the same charges might receive an OTH or something worse, potentially. And everyone on active duty is going to be in the IRR at some point if they're not past their eight-year contract when they get out of the military. And most are on four-year contracts. And they stand to spend about 4 years in the inactive reserve. And if it's not safe for these combat vets when they come home to speak their minds, then it's not safe for anyone.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We will get back to you soon. Sergeant Adam Kokesh, Iraq veteran against the war, was wearing uniform at an anti-war protest. As now, the question is, will he get something other than his honorable discharge? Specialist Evan Knappenberger, also an Iraq war vet, held an eight-day, 24-hour-a-day vigil last week in Bellingham, Washington, outside the federal building, protesting the Stop Loss program when soldiers are sent to Iraq again and again and again. We'll link to their websites at ours, democracynow.org. And if you want to see video of their protests and photographs, you can go to our website as well. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Close your eyes. Put down your gun. Rest yourself. Catch your breath. Beyond this wall, below that hill, behind that house, lies a dusty death. Yeah. You learn real fast if you're halfway smart. Keep your head down, bide your time. I've seen 100 kids like you. They take a bullet, we send them down the line. That one there, he's just a kid, he's maybe 14, but don't you be fooled. His father's father's for 200 years learned to fight in Archer school. They whipped the British and the Russians too, from the Khyber Pass to the Khaki Hills. My guess is 100 years from now, they'll be kicking asses still.
Fight to Live Another Day by Garnett Rogers. I met him at the 25th anniversary of WOJB, Ojibwe Radio, in northern Wisconsin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For our last segment today, we turn to Dave Zirin. He's been called the best young sports writer in the United States and is the country's foremost critic on sports intersection with politics. He writes the weekly column Edge of Sports at edgeofsports.com, is a regular contributor to The Nation and Slam Magazine. His books include What's My Name, Fool?, The Muhammad Ali Handbook, and he's just come out with a new one, Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports. It's got a foreword by the rap artist Chuck D of Public Enemy. Dave Zirin joins us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Dave.
Great to be here, Amy.
Why'd you call it Welcome to the Terror Dome?
Wow. I mean, I called it Welcome to the Terror Dome because I was sitting there with the rest of the country in 2005 seeing the most gruesome possible collision of sports and politics, seeing 20 to 30,000 of New Orleans' poorest residents herded into the Louisiana Superdome in conditions that I thought Jesse Jackson quite correctly likened to the hull of a slave ship, and seeing a New Orleans that didn't have enough money for emergency shelter. shelter, that didn't have enough money to even keep the levees upright, but did have enough money over the course of three decades to keep running the largest domed structure in the Western Hemisphere, was something just beyond compare. And when you consider that the folks herded in the Superdome never could have afforded a ticket, it just occurred to me that sports really isn't sports anymore. It's become an athletic industrial complex that, whether we love or hate sports, negatively impacts all of our lives.
Last night, Anderson Cooper did an expose on CNN about 100 unclaimed bodies, unidentified bodies that are being held at a warehouse in New Orleans just down the street from the Superdome.
Unbelievable. I mean, these are stories that I think would shame a B-movie horror film director. I mean, also when you consider that the Superdome, when it was built in the mid-70s, they tore down one of the famous New Orleans above-ground cemeteries to build it. They tore down one of the vestiges of Louis Armstrong's old neighborhoods to build it. And the promise was that we would see a new New Orleans business district that would rise all boats. But what we're seeing, to paraphrase Chris Rock, is that trickle-down economics doesn't always trickle down.
We're talking to Dave Zirin, whose new book is called Welcome to the Terror Dome, The Pain, Politics, and Promise of Sports.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amy. Just hearing Adam Kokesh before me, it was just so difficult not to think about Pat Tillman as well, another horrible collision of sports and politics. I mean, somebody who I think, had he lived, the former NFL player who became an Army Ranger, left millions of dollars on the table with the NFL. It's hard not to think that if he had lived, he might not have joined Adam's organization, Iraq Veterans Against the War. And instead, he just became just a horrible figure of PR in death in a way he never would have agreed to have been in life.
And Dave, you wrote extensively about Pat Tillman. You talked to his mother. There was recently hearings in Washington, D.C.,
yes.
Where his family spoke, his brother spoke, his mother spoke. Now that case being investigated, that his family was lied to after he was killed in Afghanistan. Well, tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, the case just stinks to high heaven, and even like a B-grade Mickey Spillane detective would see all the holes in this case. I mean, the fact that Pat Tillman kept an assiduous journal over the course of his life that was burned at the point of his death, the fact that they burned his uniform on the basis that it was, they called it a biochemical hazard. I mean, there's just so much that doesn't pass the smell test of this case. Usually incidents of friendly fire are incidents that involve a lot of chaos and confusion, yet the stories were down soon enough that Pat Tillman's own brother, Kevin, who was part of his platoon, was told right away that Pat Tillman had died facing enemy fire and not, in fact, had died in an incident of friendly fire. And the fact that the stories were worked out right away, so people were ready to lie over his dead body, that his family was ready to be lied to over his dead body at his own funeral, that George W. Bush was going to exploit his death and speak over the Jumbotron at the Cardinal Stadium. I mean, it's just such a horrible story all around, and the Tillmans deserve all of our support, respect, and solidarity for having the courage to say, wait a minute, we're not going to let you turn Pat Tillman into an army of one. We're actually going to tell you who he really was, somebody who was developing opposition to the war in Iraq, and we're not going to let you take his memory to support this war.
In your book, Welcome to the Terror Dome, you take on many issues. Among them, well, the first chapter, for example, mm-hmm. is relearning Roberto Clemente. Explain.
Absolutely. I mean, Roberto Clemente, he was, of course, the Pittsburgh Pirates superstar of the 1950s and 1960s. He wasn't the first Latino player. He wasn't even the first dark-skinned Latino player, but he was the first Latino superstar, the first person to cross over without, in fact, crossing over. You know, it's interesting when you hear Barack Obama tell stories about handlers trying to get him to call himself Barry Obama. And I was thinking that's what Roberto Clemente went through 30 years ago. Like, he had people telling him, call yourself Bob Clemente or Bobby Clemente. But he refused to do that. But the thing that makes Roberto Clemente important for today was that he was a person who believed very much in the question of social justice and social democracy. And he was also somebody who was greatly influenced by the black freedom struggle in this country, by having to play in a segregated minor league system, very drenched in the worst crimes of Jim Crow. And in today's day, when you have this immigration debate percolating around around the country and so many divisions in this country, particularly among communities of color, the memory of Roberto Clemente, a person who counted among his heroes Martin Luther King Jr., a person who stood in solidarity with his African-American teammates, is a memory that I think serves us well today.
The NBA and the two souls of hip-hop?
The NBA players right now have become the spittoon for every racial anxiety aslosh in the sports world. I mean, it's quite shocking if you think about it, the way the league itself has created its own kind of mini hot box of hysteria, where NBA players, based on what they dress, what they do, whether they jump up to their feet during a game, is all subject to all kinds of hand-wringing. And I think a lot of this is due to David Stern trying to figure out, gee, how do I market a majority African-American league to a majority white fan base, yet at the same time keep the league's cultural cachet and cultural capital of urban cool. Unfortunately, as I write in the book, I think David Stern has made every step an incorrect one. I mean, he's like King Midas in reverse. Everything he touches on this question of building bridges between players who come from largely poor African-American backgrounds and a largely corporate and white ticket-buying fan base has been incorrect. It's turned to garbage. And I'm harshly critical of him of that, because what he's basically done is it sanctifies an idea, really, of racial profiling, of saying that based on how a player dresses, it says something about their character. Based on the kind of music they listen to or the friends they walk around with, it says something about who they are. And all that really does is build up racial animus, and it uses sports as yet just another stick to divide us instead of bringing us together.
You talk about how people in power exploit sports, exploit the games.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because we talked early on in this segment about the way it's exploited in terms of corporate greed, but it's also exploited ideologically as well to suit their own ends. And we talked about probably the most gruesome aspect of that, which is the situation of Pat Tillman, but it also reaches almost comical heights. Like, I read an article recently about how George Steinbrenner, the infamous owner of the New York Yankees, was having his stadium security string up chains in the lower bleachers during the seventh inning stretch, where the Yankees play a second national anthem. They play God Bless America, to actually prevent people from leaving their seats, from going to the bathroom, from even sitting down. In other words, during the seventh inning stretch, you're not in fact allowed to stretch. You can only stand up and pay fealty to the flag. And Steinbrenner is quite explicit about why he's doing this. He's doing this because he supports Operation Iraqi Freedom. He wants to support the troops in the field in Iraq. And at the end of the day, though, it's like, all right, so we're going to stand up and sing a song about freedom, yet you're putting up chains to actually impel people and compel people to stand in place. I mean, it's a bizarre head-scratcher that makes you wonder who, in fact, these games are serving.
You did a sports interview, Dave Zirin, with Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row in Pennsylvania for more than a quarter century now.
Yeah, I mean, and that was a staggering experience. I mean, it started when I just received a letter in the mail from Mumia Abu-Jamal just saying he enjoyed my first book, What's My Name, Fool? And we started a correspondence, which, you know, I mean, we forget about Mumia sometimes. He's become such a symbol of the anti-death penalty movement, a symbol of the anti-racist movement, that we forget that he's an award-winning journalist and a brilliant writer. And the letters we sent back and forth just about sports and society revealed someone who, while he is definitely, I wouldn't call him an avid sports fan, he's one of the sharpest observers of culture and society who I've ever had the privilege to read. So it was a no-brainer just to ask him questions about what he feels about the state of sports and the state of resistance through sports. And his stories were amazing because it revealed somebody who, growing up as a very young freedom fighter, growing up in this country, a very young member of the Black Panther Party, I believe he joined when he was 13 years old, somebody who always saw sports as a distraction from the broader social movements, yet at the same time would always have time to talk about Muhammad Ali's latest fight, would always have the time to talk about people like Roberto Clemente, would always have an understanding that folks like Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the 1968 Olympics, when they would in fact stand up for freedom, that actually would make his job easier as somebody organizing in the streets of the United States.
Dave Zirin, thank you for being with us, author of Welcome to the Terror Dome, and that does it for the show. Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Berkshire, Hoda Kadoush, John Hamath, Elizabeth Press, Armitage, Jen Utes, Anjali Kamat, and Nicole Salazar. Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera, engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. this is Democracy Now!